Grantha Shrimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 11, entitled The Childhood Pastimes of Krishna, Text 45. Previous two verses, I'll quickly read out. Should not discuss. Thereafter, Sri Krishna caught the demon by the hind legs and tail, twirled the demon's whole body very strongly until the demon was dead, and threw him into the top of a kapitha tree, which then fell down, along with the body of the demon, who had assumed a great form. Purport. By His Divine Grace, Sri Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Krishna killed the demon in such a way as to get the kapita fruits to fall so that he and Balaram and other boys could take advantage of the opportunity to eat them. The kapita is sometimes called kshatbel phala. The pulp of this fruit is very palatable. It is sweet and sour and everyone likes it. Text 44, translation. Upon seeing the dead body of the demon, all the cowherd boys exclaimed, "Well done, Krishna, very good, very good. Thank you." In the upper planetary system, all the demigods were pleased, and therefore they showered flowers on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Translation and purport of the current verse. After the killing of the demon, Krishna and Balaram finished their breakfast in the morning, and while continuing to take care of the cows, they wandered here and there. Krishna and Balaram, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who maintained the entire creation, took charge of the cows as if cowherd boys. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya cha dushkritam. Krishna's daily business here in this material world is to kill the dushkritas. This did not hamper his daily affairs, for it was routine work. While he tended the cows on the bank of river Yamuna, two or three incidents took place every day. And although these were serious, killing the demons one after another appeared to be his daily routine work. Om jnanati mirandhasya jnananjanishalakaya chakshurunmilitam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha nama om vishnupadaya krishna prishthaya bhutale shrimate bhakti vedanta swami iti namine namaste saraswati deve gauravani pracharine nirvishesha shunyavadi paschatya deshatarine vancha kalpatarubhyascha kripa sindhubhya eva cha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha jai shri krishna chaitanya prabhu nityananda shri advaita gadadhara shrivasadi gaura bhakta vrinda hare krishna 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 hare 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 rama 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 hare 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 Krishna. So today morning, we are discussing the childhood pastimes of Krishna. And here Srila Prabhupada explains how killing the demons was a part of his routine work in this world. So I'll continue on the theme. I'll come to this theme as I continue from the theme which I addressed yesterday. Yesterday I spoke on the nature of illusion, and how the illusion of Maya is different from the illusion of Leela. So illusion is not just, it is hallucination means this, there is some perception without any object. Illusion means the object is there, but it's perceived wrongly. And impersonalists consider that both the subject and the object are illusion, only the stream of consciousness is reality. Whereas the Vaishnavas understand that the object is real, the subject is real. The illusion is caused because of the contamination in the subject. The sense objects are not the source of illusion. They are the trigger of illusion. And basically the contamination, it changes, sabotages our intention. And Maya is a person. At the same time, she is practically acting essentially through the mind. And she offers us various options like a multiple choice exam. The purpose of Maya is not to thwart, to attempt and thwart us. It is to test us. And to the extent we desire Krishna more than the things of this world, we can come out of illusion. So for us, there are contaminations inside us and there is Maya above us. And both of them, because of which we are put in illusion. On the other hand, in the case of Krishna, there are no contaminations inside him, and Maya is below him. So therefore, there is no illusion possible for him. Now, I'll make a few more points about illusion before we move on to divine illusion. The nature of illusion is that it is a network and it is self-perpetuating. Network means that the conditioned soul is not just put in one illusion. It is, Krishna says in the 16th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that aneka chitta vibhranta moha jala samavrataha prasaktah kama bhogeshu patanti narakeshu chau. 16.16 says aneka chitta vibhranta, the consciousness is pulled in different directions, and moha jala samavrataha. Jala is like a net. So it is not just moha, but there is moha jala, a net of illusion, and moha jala samavrataha. Person is completely covered by that. Prasaktaha kama bhogeshu. Because of the desire to enjoy worldly pleasures, patanti narakeshu chau. That person succumbs to hellish suffering. Now, in this sequence of verses, Krishna has earlier referred to asha as a pash. Asha pash chatair baddha kama krodha parayanaha. Ihante kama bhogartham anyayenartha sanchayan. So, asha pasha chatair baddha. Pasha is like a rope, or more specifically a noose. So, in warfare in the past, or in fighting in the past, when a person is running away, you can catch them by throwing a noose around them. The noose falls around them and pulls them. So, asha pasha means desire is like a noose that catches a person. And similarly, a person can be caught, you know, by throwing a net on them. The net just, they don't know what to do. Just like fish are caught with a net. Like that, the person can be caught by a net. Now, when there is a pash, there is basically one rope. There's one rope that is there. Whereas when there is a jala, there is samavrittaha. The word that is used, word is, it's not just one desire that is restricting. Rather, it is a network of illusions that is restraining, that is fettering. Now, normally, we think of desires as something that activate people. Because of desires, people run here and there. Chaitanya Charitamrita says, jivhera lalasa ye iti uti dhai. That because of the desire to enjoy food with the tongue, people go here, go there, go there. So, normally, we think of desires as that which makes people go here and there. Normally we think of desires as energizing. Maybe in a negative direction. But desires are energizing. Whereas the Bhagavad Gita is talking about desires as restricting. So there are, you know, why is this difference there? That normally if a person has a desire, they will try to say climb up Mount Everest, something. They will try to, you know, form a relationship. They'll try to do this, buy this, get that. Desires are what are energizing. But both these metaphors, pasha and jala, noose and net, both of them talk about restraining. So actually, it depends on what is the primary purpose that a person is conceiving in their life. Say if somebody is an alcoholic, and they want to be alcoholics. They just want to enjoy alcohol. Especially when people are young and they have not yet experienced the consequences of excessive alcohol indulgence. At that time, they think of drinking alcohol as freedom. Even if they have some, their parents have told them, don't indulge in this so much and be careful about these things. They think this is freeing. I want to do it. So desires, they initially seem to be energizing. But, because they feel, I'm going to do something new, I'm going to be free, I'm going to enjoy. But eventually, if that person recognizes the dangers of alcoholism, and then they want to give it up. When they're trying to recover from alcohol, they want to go on to do their normal work, say this is home, this is office, they want to go to office, but along the way there's a bar. Then they're pulled in that direction. So they don't have the freedom to do what they want to do, because the desires are pulling them. So, when when we have more or less surrendered to our desires, then the desires appear to be energizing. They appear to be freeing. But when we have some higher intention, apart from whatever desires we might be having, then we see the desires as restraining. So I want to do this particular thing, but I'm just not able to do it. You know, a student who seriously wants to study, but the student has got, hooked on to surfing on the net. I want to study, but then the desire comes. You know, come on, just see what's the latest update on Facebook. What's the latest news? What's the latest cricket score? What is this? What is that? And it pulls them. So, if the struggle happens, the inner struggle happens when there is a conflict between the intention and the desire. When both are same, there is no conflict. Now, the two can be same in two cases. When the person has succumbed to the desire, or when the person has conquered the desire. So for those who are fully materialists, they have succumbed to the desire. They have made their intention and the same as their desire. In that case, then they don't feel much struggle. Their only struggle is, okay, how will I get the object by which I can enjoy? They don't feel any inner struggle. There is only outer struggle to get the object by which they can enjoy. But in the case of pure devotees who are free from desires, or not even pure devotees, with respect to particular desires, say somebody who has decided that I'm not going to drink alcohol. In their case, there is no desire. So the intention is, okay, this is home, this is office, let me go straight. Then there is no conflict. So the inner conflict happens because of the presence of desire and intention being in two different directions. And the solution to this is either we ensure that the intention wins over the desire, or the desire wins over the intention. And now, of course, the desire winning over the intention is not the solution, because whenever the desire does win over the intention, even after that, the desire doesn't get exhausted. It is Dushpuren analena cha. Dushpura. Dushpura means that which is never satisfied. So now, in the case of illusion, the way it works is that the desire pops up either internally through recollection or externally through perception. See, the alcoholic, they see an object, they see a bar, they see somebody drinking, they see an advertisement of a drink. And then that causes the desire to pop up. Or it might pop up internally through recollection. Let me just remember, because of something. There is no perception outside, but recollection. And when that pops up, then whatever is their intention, that intention becomes weakened by the desire. And as the desire keeps growing, then their intention starts getting weaker and weaker. Now, when illusion works in this way, in the process of purification essentially means that our desire, by desire and intention, now there is a relationship also between the two. The same desire, when we cultivate it stronger and stronger, it becomes intention. So then that desire, when it becomes intention, then our original intention gets sabotaged. Our original intention gets lost. But here we are talking about a core intention that we have and a circumstantial desire that has popped up. And there's a conflict between this circumstantial desire and the core intention. And at such a time, what keeps a distance between that circumstantial desire and the core intention, that is the intelligence. The stronger the intelligence, the greater will be the gap between the two. And the weaker the intelligence, the two become one. How the two become one? The core desire becomes the intention. The circumstantial desire becomes the intention. And that's why in the sequence, when Krishna talks from 2.62 to 63, Dhyayato Vishayan Pumsaha, he says, last stage is Buddhi Nashat Pranashyati. When the intelligence is lost, everything is lost. So the intelligence is the last protector for the soul. When the intelligence is overcome, then we accept the desire as our intention. So basically the mind offers a proposition, or the world offers a proposition. And when the intelligence accepts the proposition, then it becomes an intention. And when the intelligence, accepts the proposition, it becomes an intention, that's when our higher plans, our practice of bhakti, even our purposeful execution of responsibility to the material life, they get sabotaged. Now, in the case of Krishna, when there is a leela happening, so this is how Maya works. So Maya basically, that it is the perception that comes either from external or the recollection that comes from internal. Now, some of us, we usually understand that by our past karma, sometimes sometimes some suffering comes in our life. You know, suddenly things go wrong, we lose our job, our health gets spoiled, our relationships go sore. Now, if we have done nothing to kindle this, suddenly it's happening on its own, or we've done a small thing and a big thing is happening as a result, then we understand that is by past karma. But what we need to understand also is that sometimes past karma may pop up as increased desires also. When Ajamil was going along the road, you know, how was it that he happened to see that Shudra and Shudrani over there? His going along the road at that particular time, that was by past karma. He could have been going before, he could have been going after. So our exposure to temptation, that happens by past karma. Sometimes we feel in Kali Yuga, you know, there are so many temptations all around us. It's so difficult to live a pure life. Yes, that is true. But then, why are we born in Kali Yuga? Now, it's because of our own past karma, where we have repeatedly desired to engage in worldly pleasures, that we are born in an arena where the worldly pleasures are so profusely available. So just as the circumstances that we face in our life, with whatever temptation levels are there, high or low, they are by our past karma. Similarly, sometimes even our mind's moods are affected by our past karma, are influenced by our past karma. Sometimes for no reason, suddenly, you know, our desires may just shoot up. And we may start feeling very irritable and angry. We may start feeling very greedy. Start feeling, I just need to earn more. Or we start feeling more of lusty desire. We start feeling too much of envy. So all this, there's not much of a perception, but suddenly those desires are popping up more and more. We have to understand this is also a result of past karma. And that happens at that time. The response is tams titiksha swabharata, tolerate. That's why Krishna in that verse 2.14, he talks about tolerating both externals and internals. Both our externals and our internals, they are a result of past karma. That's why Krishna says, ya matra sparshastu kaunte shitoshna sukha dukkada agam apayino nitya stam titiksha swabharata. So shit ushna is external, sukha dukha is internal. Both need to be tolerated, tam titiksha. It means both are resulting from past karma, and just tolerate them. Just as we live in sometimes in some place, part of the world where the heat is too much. Sometimes we may live in a part of the world where the cold is too much. We just tolerate it. We understand that is the environmental climate of that place. We just have to tolerate it. So similarly, we all, as souls, the soul is encased in two coverings. There's the mind and the body. Now, just as the bodily covering in which the soul is encased is a result of past karma, the mental covering in which the soul is encased is also a result of past karma. So just as the physical climate that we find ourselves in is a result of past karma, similarly, the emotional climate we find ourselves in is also a result of past karma. So sometimes we may just find ourselves, when suddenly this desire shoot up, particular artha start rising, at that time we understand that this is a result of past karma. So Krishna Chari, he says, Tam Sitiksha Subhatma, just tolerate it. Just as you tolerate increase in temperature or decrease in temperature. So like that, we tolerate the increase in desire also. Sometimes we feel happy, sometimes we feel sad. But these are circumstantial emotions. See, we usually, although we understand that I'm not the body and the soul, but still, we often define external and internal in terms of the body. So therefore, whatever emotions are there, we think they are internal. And okay, and the weather is external. But from the soul's perspective, even the mind is external. And that's why the emotions that just come and go in our mind, they are not our emotions. They are just something which is popping up in the mind because of our past karma. Just like it's my computer. Yesterday I gave the example of software and hardware. The mind is like the software, the computer is like the hardware. Sometimes, you know, while we are just working on a computer, suddenly something pops up. Do you want to install this update? Do you want to change the setting of the software? Do you want to install this new software? Whatever. Now we did nothing, it suddenly popped up. We have not even visited any website to get that pop. Suddenly it pops up. So that's the software prompting it. So like that, our mind sometimes prompts things. Now, when this happens, that the mind prompts something, at that time, we understand that actually, still this is external to me. And to remember the mind is external to me, it is so vital to practice bhakti diligently. Because to distance ourselves from the body is not that difficult. Because the body is, although we intellectually understand I'm not the body, I'm the soul. And the body has certain needs which we take care of. But the mind is something whose needs are not regulated. The body, we know, okay, this is the time I need, this much time I need to sleep, this much time I need to eat. These are things which I need to do to take care of my body. But the mind, when it starts wanting something, its wants become disproportionate. It wants something and just that want consumes our consciousness. And unless we are vigilant to identify that, to remember that I'm not the mind, we get consumed by that, thinking these are my desires. And afterwards I wonder, why did I do that? What made me do that? Sometimes, you know, we become angry and just blast out at people. And suppose, you know, if while we were angry and we blasted out, somebody recorded what we spoke. You know, and then they played the recording back to us. Hey, was that me? Was that me or was someone else who spoke through me? What is happening? So what has happened is that it was that emotion circumstantially in our mind that just took control of us. So when we are vigilant in our bhakti practices, then we remember that our mind is different from me. Now, sometimes when we are chanting and the mind wanders so much, we feel, what is the use of this chanting? But even if we are not able to concentrate on the chanting, just the attempt to chant reminds us that there is something inside me that is not me. It's only when we try to focus the mind, focus our consciousness on Krishna and the mind doesn't allow, that reminds us, there's something inside me, this is not me. This is something different from me. So now, why are we talking about the body, mind and soul here when we are discussing about Krishna Leela? Because for Krishna, there is no difference between the body, mind and soul. For Krishna, dehe deha dehe dehi vibhedoyam. In the Varaha Purana, it is said that deha and dehi, the body and the embodied. So, embodied being, for and it comes to the absolute, the two of them are actually one. And that's why for the two of them, for Krishna, there is no inner desire that will sabotage him. Externally, of course, Maya is under his control. Because Maya is under his control, Maya is his energy. So in that sense, there is no one to sabotage him. Whatever Krishna does is out of pure spiritual intention. He also has desires. See, again, this leads to a fundamental difference between Vaishnava understanding and impersonalist understanding. The impersonalist understanding is that desire itself is an illusion. They say desire is the cause of suffering. And desirelessness will be the freedom from suffering. The Bhagavatam also echoes this theme, but in a particular context. I mean, the Pingala story, it is concluded by saying that in the 11th canto in the Uddhava Gita, that Ashahi paramam dukkham, nairashyam paramam sukham. That desire is the cause of great misery. If you're free from desire, then we'll be free from misery. We will become happy. However, if we see her prayers before that, her realizations before that, Pingala is speaking that now I'm going to take shelter of Lord Narayan. Just as Lakshmi Devi takes shelter, I'm going to take shelter and I'm going to serve him, absorb myself in him, delight in him. So she does have spiritual desires. So now the impersonalist idea is all desires are the state of, or signify a state of illusion. Because the conception is that the state of purity is the state of desirelessness. So, when I desire something, that means there is something outside of me. There is, as I said, that there is subject and there is object. So, if I see something, then I desire it. But the impersonalist idea is that the subject and the object both are illusion. So then how can there be any desire at all? Because in a sense, everything that exists is me. That is their conception. So what is there to desire at all? There are many problems with this reasoning. First of all, you know, if this, the impersonalist say that the subject, the idea of a subject, object, this is illusion. And that's why the desire that comes, that's also an illusion. But the question that comes, whenever we talk about illusion, you know, there has to be somebody who goes into illusion, isn't it? Whenever there is illusion, okay, you know, if I'm walking in a desert and I see a mirage, hey, you're in illusion. Yes, it's possible that I'm in illusion, but, you know, I am an illusion. I am not an illusion. There has to be, for illusion to be present, there has to be some real pursuer who's an illusion. I can be an illusion, but I cannot be an illusion. The observed can be an illusion. The observer has to be real. The mirage, the seeing the desert as a mirage is an illusion. But the seer itself has to be real, otherwise there cannot be any perception of illusion at all. There has to be some real perceiver. So to dismiss the subject itself as illusion and therefore to say that all desires are illusion, this is a serious misunderstanding. As soon as there is a subject who is real, that subject will observe. And when we observe, there are natural responses to what we observe. When we observe something, you know, we like someone. Oh, this person is nice. We don't like someone. This is not so nice. You know, we desire something. We don't like something. We desire something very strongly. Some things we don't desire so much. So this kind of duality is a natural result of desires. So now, the impersonalists hold that all duality is illusion. And all that is there is oneness. Now in Krishna there is oneness. But what is the oneness? For Krishna the oneness is that his body, mind and soul are one. So in that sense, because his body, mind and soul are one, there is no duality created within him because of anything inside him sabotaging or anything outside him sabotaging. In the Nectar of Devotion introduction, Prabhupada says that Krishna is actually all the five things. In the Bhagavad Gita, the five subjects are talked about. There is Jiva, Ishvara, Prakriti, Kala and Karma. There is a soul, there is God, there is material nature, there is time and there is activity. And he explains that actually Krishna is all these five. So at one level we say Krishna is Ishvara, Krishna is God. Yes, Krishna is God. But the Bhagavad Gita does not offer a fragmented conception of a God who exists above his creation. The Bhagavad Gita offers, yes, there is God as a person existing, but God is also integrated with his creation. In the sense that all of creation is his energy. So there is nothing outside Krishna, because Krishna is everything. Because Krishna is everything. So for Krishna, there is no duality, in the sense that there is nothing outside him which he may desire or he may not desire. Now, at the same time, for Krishna, because he is Purna, he is complete, everything exists inside him. And in that sense, there is no possibility for him to perceive anything wrongly. He perceives everything purely. He perceives everything absolutely. Whereas for us, because we are subjects of perception, and we are limited. We see something else. Now we see that thing from our perspective. And our perspective is limited. So we can go into illusion. So the difference between Maya and Leela is what we are discussing right now. And that difference comes primarily from who is the central actor. In Maya, it is the soul who is being deluded. In Leela, also there is a kind of illusion. The illusion is Krishna forgets that he is God. The devotees, the Vrajavasis, they don't remember that Krishna is God. But this is all in the realm of transcendence. It's all in the realm of transcendence. Because Krishna exists at the transcendental realm. Now we will talk about, I'll be taking two more classes on Friday, Saturday and Sunday. At that time I'll go deeper into the concept of Leela. But here I'll speak two more points about what happens when Krishna descends to this world. No. When Krishna descends to this world, at that time, it's a very extraordinary phenomenon. Because the unlimited is manifesting in this limited world. Krishna himself is unlimited. Krishna shows his unlimitedness when Mother Yashoda asks him to open his mouth. And he sees the whole universe is inside him. Not only is the whole universe inside him, but even inside the universe, Yashoda Mai sees herself looking at the mouth of Krishna. So that means, even when Krishna is inside the universe is inside Krishna. That is the paradox. Even when the universe is inside Krishna, Krishna is inside the universe. So, the nature of God is that everything exists inside him and he exists inside everything. The nature of God is that everything exists inside him and he exists inside everything. Sarva bhutastam atmanam sarva bhutani chatmani ikshate yoga yukta atma sarvatra samadarshanaha. Bhagwan ki jai. Sarva bhutastham atmanam. Here the word atma refers to the supreme being. This is 6.29 in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna is saying that sarva bhutastham, that all living beings exist in him. So everything exists inside him. Sarva bhutastham atmanam. Sarva bhutastham atmanam. He says he exists in all living beings. Sarva bhutani chatmani, and all living beings exist inside him. This is the inconceivable nature of God. That he, as it is said, that he is greater than the greatest, he is smaller than the smallest. Mahato mahiyan anoraniyan. Now, that absolute truth, who exists beyond this world in his own abode, when he descends to this world. At that time, the absolute truth is, this is the junction between the material world and the spiritual world. The spiritual world is here, the material world is here. Now, of course, this kind of depiction, it is fine for understanding. The spiritual world is transcendental. So we cannot really pin it down to a geographical location. Now, it's like, say, UK is here, France is here. It's not like that. You know, geographically cover a distance and we go from UK to France. So it's, the spiritual world is not in the geographical neighborhood of the material world. The spiritual world exists in a different level of existence. It's only for the sake of depiction we say that, okay, the material world is here, the spiritual world is here. When we say show them as existing in neighborhood, now, we may get the conception that both exist at the same level of reality. France and UK exist at the same level of reality. India and Pakistan exist at the same level of reality. Go from India to Pakistan. But the material world and spiritual world, they exist at entirely different levels of reality. That's why it's not just like they're not like next to each other and there is one physical border. We cross over and go over there. The border is there, but the border is not physical. The border is conceptual. The differentiation between spiritual and physical world, spiritual world and physical world, is primarily a difference of consciousness. So when Krishna comes from the spiritual world to the material world, it's not like, say, a person, say, you know, takes a flight from and comes from America to UK. It's not like that. It's not just physical relocation that is involved over there. Because Krishna does not have a physical form. The spiritual world does not have a physical location. But the point which we are making is, still, when Krishna descends to this world, that which is transcendental is being manifested in this world. Now, how does the transcendental manifest? So, Jiva Goswami, in his Sandarbhas, is very categorical in establishing that even when the Lord comes under this in this world, he doesn't come under illusion. He remains transcendental. He remains sublime. How does that happen? That is because he himself is the Lord of material nature. He's the Lord of material nature. Prabhupada gives a simple example, which we will discuss much more in detail in the future class. Prabhupada says that, you know, if there is a jail, and normally people who reside in the jail are prisoners, and they are under the ambit of the criminal law. That's how they have come in the jail. Now, if the king decides to visit the jail, the king is not under the ambit of the criminal law. Although the king is geographically in the same location as those other people who are under the ambit of the criminal law, the king is not. So like that, Krishna comes within the material world, but he doesn't come under material consciousness because he is transcendental. Now, why does Srila Prabhupada emphasize this concept that Krishna doesn't come under illusion? Because there are various other conceptions of the descent of the Lord. There are two main conceptions. There is the Judeo-Christian conception, and then there is the impersonalist conception. So in the Christian conception, actually the word incarnation, that has come primarily from the Christian tradition, where Jesus was expected to be the Messiah, and he was expected to deliver his people. But when Jesus was killed, his followers were devastated. And then for almost four centuries, Christians thereafter were debating who was Jesus. And finally, after several centuries, the Nicene Creed, they decided that Jesus was both fully man and fully God. So they said the divinity of Christ was manifested in the humanity of Jesus. So their idea is Jesus was fully human and fully God. Because many reasons for this. But their idea is that when Jesus was about to die, when he was being crucified, at that time he exhibited two radically different emotions. Now, when he was being raised on the cross and he was initially being crucified, he cried out in agony, "Oh Father, why have thou forsaken me? Why have thou forsaken me?" So this is a expression of doubting God, of questioning God, of feeling abandoned by God. And then later on, he is said to have said that actually, that, "Oh, forgive them, for they know not what they do." So they said that at this time, when he is actually being crucified initially, at that time, he's exhibiting his humanity. That we humans may feel forsaken by God at times. But when he's seeking their forgiveness, he's manifesting his divinity. He's acting as God, all forgiving. So either way, the Christians have the idea that when God descends to this world, they have the word incarnation. That the very word incarnation has a particular meaning. That karna means flesh, like we have carnivorous animals. So carnivorous animals means that those which eat flesh. So incarnation means to come in flesh. Like we have the word reincarnation. To come again in flesh, to come again in the material body. So incarnation means to come in flesh. So when God comes in flesh, that is, God came as Jesus. That's what they call as incarnation. Now Prabhupada was very categorical. And if Krishna comes in this world, he does not come in flesh. So the word incarnation has one meaning, come in flesh. But the word incarnation also means manifestation. So Prabhupada uses the word incarnation in the sense of manifestation. Just appears, but not in flesh. So if we have the idea that when Krishna comes to this world, he comes in flesh, then that means he's got a material body, and that means that material body will be subjected to material illusions. The impersonalist idea is that God, when he descends to this world, he actually comes, he is the absolute truth covered by illusion. So the absolute truth is impersonal, but that absolute truth temporarily becomes personal. So we'll talk about this also again later, but more in detail. When you contrast the impersonalist understanding of Leela with the Vaishnava understanding of Leela. But why is it important to understand that Krishna does not come in a material form? Because Krishna is capable of delivering us. Krishna is always beyond Maya, and he's always capable of taking us beyond Maya. So one way of trying to overcome illusion is through discrimination. You know, this is Maya. This is false. This is real. This is temptation. This is serious practice. So one way of trying to overcome temptation is through discrimination. The other way of overcoming illusion is through devotion. Now, devotion means we just surrender to Krishna. We take shelter of Krishna. Now, we may use discrimination in service of our devotion. But in bhakti, our basis of overcoming maya, overcoming temptation, is not discrimination. This is false. This is real. This is false. This is real. Devotees are not constantly obsessed with that. Devotees' focus is, how can I serve Krishna? Devotees' focus is, it is through the power of devotion. If I serve Krishna, Krishna will protect me. It is not that by my intelligence, you know, this is temptation, I will not fall for it. This is not, devotee is not thinking that way. Devotees use the intelligence, but we use the intelligence not to overcome temptation. We use the intelligence to serve Krishna. And as a part of our service to Krishna, we also fight against temptations. But our focus, we don't think that it is by our discrimination we will overcome illusion. It is by our devotion that Krishna will free us from illusion. And if we have to have that devotion, then that faith underlying that Krishna will free us from illusion, we have to have the faith that Krishna is beyond illusion. So, even when Krishna performs Leela, even when Krishna is Mugdha Iva, he is not under illusion. Prabhupada explains in the purport over here that Krishna would kill the demons when it was necessary, but still he was just performing Leela. He was not affected. You know, when we have to fight a war, even if there is a war for a just cause, so it's a very serious matter. It's a very serious matter where we have to plan and we have to anticipate attacks and prepare for counterattacks. But for Krishna, it was simply play. Krishna was not at all at this material level of reality. Krishna was fully at the transcendental level of reality, absorbed in devotion, absorbed in pure reciprocation of love. And thus, effortlessly. Now, for Krishna, he broke the tree, he killed the demon, but he simply used the killing of the demon as a means to further his own Leela. His Leela was, in the forest, he wanted to eat fruits. So he killed the demon, and he ensured that the demon's body fell in such a way that fruits fell down, and he ate the fruits. So for him, killing the demons was just a passing business. It was not the central activity of his life. It was, Krishna was never caught in the hubbub, in the passion, in the illusion of material existence. Krishna always remains transcendental. And by having faith in Krishna's transcendence, we can, by surrendering to Him, also gradually rise towards transcendence. So to summarize, I spoke today, continuing on the discussion of the nature of illusion and how Krishna is not an illusion. I spoke about the the concept of illusion. Where does illusion come from? There is a core intention and there is a peripheral temptation or a peripheral desire, peripheral proposition that comes. Now, if the inner conflict exists when there is a difference between intention and proposition. So the Bhagavad Gita uses desires in a two metaphors of restraining. That as shackles, pash, noose, and as net, pash, as jala. So we feel our desires as energizing if we want to give into the desires. But if we want to do something else, and then the desires are obstructing us. Just like a person who's wanting to drink alcohol, for them, the desire for alcohol is energizing. But for a person who wants to give up alcohol, the desire for alcohol is restraining. So the struggle between what we intend to do and what we feel like doing, that is the domain of inner struggle. If somebody is totally materialistic, then they don't feel the struggle. If somebody is fully spiritual, they don't feel the struggle. In between, we feel the struggle. And the desire, the proposition may come externally through some perception, or the proposition may come internally through some recollection. And in either case, we have to stay fixed in our intention. And how to do that? Tam Sitiksha Subharata. We understand that the external perception, as a Jamil's seeing the degraded scene, that is a result of past karma. So we live in Kali Yuga where there are so many temptations. That's because of our own past karma, that pure life is so difficult. But just as the environmental weather, environmental climate is a result of that we live in, is a result of our past karma. Similarly, our emotional weather, some of us may be more moody, some of us suddenly start feeling greedy, envious, angry. But then this we also understand is a result of past karma. So just calm, Siddhiksha, so tolerate. It will go away in due course of time. And the impersonalist idea is that desire itself is an illusion. But desire is not an illusion, because there has to be, the perception can be an illusion, the perceiver has to be real. But the Krishna, he's real, for him the body, mind and the soul are one. So that's why there is no sabotaging of his intentions. There is no his coming under illusion. Because for us, the soul has its spiritual intention, but the mind and the body, they come up with various propositions. That's how we go into illusion. And Krishna is not just a God. Krishna is not just one among the five truths. Ishvara, Jiva, Kala, Karma, Prakriti. Krishna is Ishvara, but Krishna is also all the five truths. Because Krishna is, everything exists as Krishna's energy. So Krishna is not... Krishna is not just a God who exists above the creation. Krishna is also a God who pervades all of creation. And when Krishna descends to this world, he doesn't take a body of matter. He does not incarnate in the sense of taking a fleshly body. He doesn't come under illusion at all. The Christian conception of incarnation is that God becomes human when he comes. But the Vaishnava understanding is that based on the Bhagavata, Krishna always remains transcendental. And we as devotees, we don't focus primarily on our discrimination. Although we need to discriminate, but we don't focus on our discrimination to resist the proposition to focus on our intention. We just focus on Krishna and try to serve Krishna. We overcome illusion not so much by discrimination as by devotion. The more we have conviction that Krishna is transcendental, then by our devotion to Krishna, we have the faith that Krishna will make us transcendental. Krishna will weaken the propositions that are coming. And Krishna will strengthen our intentions and we'll be able to march steadily towards Him. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.